Hello and welcome to the latest podcast from the Glasgow Centre for Population Health, supporting new approaches to improve health and tackle inequality. In this podcast, Anna Coote, Principal Fellow at the New Economics Foundation, argues the case for universal basic services. This was recorded in front of a live audience in Glasgow as part of the GCPH seminar series on the 4th of February 2020.
Thank you very much, James, and thank you for inviting me here. It's an electric shock off this one. It's very good to be here, very good to be out of England. And we won't say any more about that just now. So I'm going to talk about universal basic services, and I want to start by saying, you know, how we got round to using this phrase and having and writing this book, indeed. My co-author, Andrew Percy, is at University College London, and he, with colleagues at, including Jonathan Portes and Howard Reed, at the Institute for Global Prosperity at UCL, were the first to come up in 2017 with a document that made the case for universal basic services. And it was very much a critique. It sort of came off the back of a critique of universal basic income. But this idea has a life of its own and should not be regarded simply as a counterpoint to UBI. I will cover some of that in my talk, but it is an idea on its own. And I was very attracted to this notion because of all the work I've done, really, since I, you know, over the last 20 years at least, working at the King's Fund, at the Institute for Public Policy, and various other places, and then at the New Economics Foundation, where I've been working on the idea of, you know, how do we think about the future of the welfare state? And this piece of work is built on all of that. So it's a short book. It's a polemic in a way. It's saying, you know, this is why we think it matters, but it does give it does have a sort of long history of developing ideas about the future of the welfare state, or the welfare system, perhaps we should talk about, and what it's going to be like and how we can make it work better than it does, and so on. So this is about UBS, what it means, why it matters, and how we can make it happen. Now, obviously, you want to know what UBS means. So I've always found it's easier to explain if you take the three words in reverse order. So for services, we're talking about collectively generated activities that serve the public interest. Collectively generated is important there. Basic means services that are essential, not about anything minimum, it's about services that are essential that enable everybody to meet their own needs. And universal is about everybody being entitled to services that are sufficient to meet their needs, regardless of ability to pay. So that's what we mean by universal basic services. Now, why does it matter now? Why have we got to this point where we need to talk about UBS? I mean, I don't really need to labour these points to you, I think, but we do have, you know, widening inequalities, widening health inequalities. We've got, you know, deepening poverty, and then this accelerating drive towards catastrophic climate change. And then the threat to the labour market of AI and robotics. And we've got public services that are really very badly damaged by too many years of anti-state policies and austerity. And then behind all that is the thing about the collective values of the post-war settlement have been pushed out by market values. So we've been told a story about individualism and choice and competition and consumerism. And maybe many of you here have been through the years when, you know, these ideas first came in. I remember it very well. And suddenly we were talking, instead of talking about services, we were talking about market rules and how this would make everything better. And so the whole story about the welfare system has changed in a very damaging way. So the guiding principles of universal basic services are as follows. There are three guiding principles. The first is shared needs. Now, the need theory is a very important basis for this this piece of work that we've done, this sort of framing of universal basic services, and it's about life's essentials. This is about getting what you need in order to survive and to flourish. And needs are things that we all have, and they are not about having, not like wants and preferences. It's about sufficiency. And there's quite a lot that I could say. In fact, I had another slide on the needs, but I've taken it out because I thought it might get into too much detail. But need theory is important. It's about we all share certain basic needs. And then there's another body of what are called intermediate needs that enable us to fulfill our basic needs. Our basic needs are basically health and critical autonomy, which enable us to participate in society. And then there's a range of things that we need in order to make that happen. In fact, I've got a list of them here. Water, nutrition, shelter, secure and non-threatening work, education, healthcare, security and childhood, significant primary relationships, physical and economic security, and a safe environment. And the point about these needs is that we all have them across time and space. But the ways in which the needs are met are different in different kinds of societies and in different times in history. So if you can keep that in your mind when I'm talking about universal basic services, it's about meeting needs in a sufficient way, and it's very different from wants and preferences, because there's no limit to how much we can want and how much we can prefer, but there's the underneath the idea of shared human needs is this idea of sufficiency. Then the second principle is collective responsibilities, and this is about pooling resources and sharing risks so that we can all meet all our needs, not just because it sounds like a nice thing to do, but because it is the very fundamental of social life. It's how we make society, and we need to reclaim this notion. And then the third principle, which is a relative newcomer to the whole discourse about welfare policy or social policy, is sustainable development. And that's about meeting the needs of the present without compromising the ability of future generations to meet their own needs. That's actually a direct quote from the Brundtland report, which was the first, I think, good definition of sustainable development. So what we do now has to be able to meet, we have to be able to meet our needs without creating conditions that make it impossible for future generations to meet their needs. Now, another way of thinking about universal basic services is to use what is sort of an old-fashioned term, which is the social wage. We used to talk about this more than we do now, and it's another thing I think we need to think about. You know, it's about the value of services to us as a sort of instead of income. So we all expect to be able to buy some of life's essentials ourselves, provided we have enough money to do so. And food and clothing is an example. And then there are some things that we need and we can buy for ourselves, but only if public policies ensure that they are available and affordable. And in that category, I might put housing and access to transport and to digital information. And then there are things that we need, but we couldn't afford to buy them ourselves unless we were pretty rich, or very rich, depending. And those would include things like education, healthcare, childcare, adult social care. So the social wage, what the social wage does is it provides collective services for life's essentials that people cannot afford to pay for themselves. So it's a virtual income. And that can be done in a number of ways, and it might be about providing them directly, or it might be about making them available for, so that everyone can afford them, and I'll come on to that. It's not all done in the same way. And in addition to that, the social wage includes income support so that everyone has enough money to pay for the essentials that we would expect in our culture to be able to pay for ourselves. So that's the social wage. Something else going on next door. So I'll crack on. So our proposal is that we need and we should have more and better public services that are available to all according to need, not ability to pay. And that we need to start by thinking about improving and extending existing services, such as schooling and healthcare. But, and this is critical to what we're proposing, is that we expand the range of services to include childcare, adult social care, housing, transport, and access to digital information. And indeed, there are more services that we could extend the principles to. So those are just the ones we focused on in the book, but I wouldn't say that's where we need to stop, because you could think in terms of, well, utilities are an obvious example, libraries and things like that. But so it's what we need, the idea that we pool our resources and take collective action to provide these things to everyone according to need, not ability to pay. Plus, and we always say this because you can't have one without the other, it must be combined with a reformed social security system that's sufficient and non-stigmatising for all so that no one's income falls below an agreed level. Now, some people say, okay, so what's so radical about that? And is it just more of the same? Well, I think there are at least three reasons why this proposal is radical. Firstly, because we are trying to reclaim the collective ideal that has been so badly swamped by the neoliberal politics of the last two or three decades. And because collective action is the only way we can move forward and meet all our needs. Secondly, because it promotes sustainable development. It's very, you know, this is at the centre of the agenda. It's not just an add-on, it's at the centre of the agenda. It's a needs-based approach that allows for sufficiency for all across generations. And thirdly, it's not, as I say, about more of the same. Inherent in this proposal is that we transform public services so that they're controlled by the people who need them and that they're adequately supported by public funds and institutions. So we want to transform the services, not just have more of them. And just to expand that, firstly, we need public expenditure on public services that is regarded as an investment in the social infrastructure, not just public spending going out of the door, as it were. So it's about valuing and building the social infrastructure. Secondly, we say that there's a lot we can learn from the experience that we've got. I mean, we've obviously got some very good universal basic services up and running already. They may be flawed, but there's an awful lot to value in them, and there's a great deal that we can learn from the experience that we've had so far of universal basic services. So there's plenty to build on there. And then what needs to be embedded in this idea is the idea of entitlement, is entitlement. So it's not just something that is given to people, but it is something that people are entitled to. And we tend to assume, actually I'm not sure what the situation in Scotland is, forgive me, but people in England think that they're entitled to healthcare. And there is a thing called the NHS Constitution. But actually, it's not anything that you could enforce in a court of law. So we have to think differently about rights and entitlements and what they consist of and how they are constructed and how they are enforced. So you need both the substantive rights and you need the procedural rights so that you can have an agreed set of rules for how you understand what your entitlements are and how you can claim them. That's a tricky area. I'm not suggesting any of this is easy. That's particularly tricky, but it has to rest on entitlement, not just on a privilege or an idea that you're, somebody else is going to be nice to you. And then we want to have multiple models of ownership. Some people find this a bit uncomfortable. They say, oh no, you know, once you let other kinds of organizations start providing services, it's the thin end of the wedge and you're going to get the private sector in. But I've become convinced that we have to try to build a body of services that are made up by a body of an array of different kinds of models of ownership and control. They might include cooperatives, they might include social enterprises. The one guiding rule would be that we try to work towards eliminating the profit motive from the organisations that provide the services. It could be a rule that there are no profit-making organisations who are providing services, but that we allow for a wide range of different models, including as many as possible that are based near where people live, that people have feel they've got direct access to, direct control over. And so it's about encouraging that multiplicity, if you like, of models of ownership and control for the different kinds of services. And this suggests there's a new dynamic between top-down and bottom-up politics that I think is grounded in, needs to be grounded in democratic dialogue. So, for example, we might envisage citizens' assemblies, a system of citizens' assemblies that was able to identify what the services should be, how they, you know, what the limits should be, how we would do the enforcement of entitlement and things like that. So that's how it's envisaged. So that's another reason why it's radical. Now, this has obviously very important implications for the role of the state. So what we say about the role of the state is this, that of course the state will continue to provide directly some services. There are some areas where it would be crazy for the state not to provide those services. But as I've tried to explain, we are not envisaging a return to sort of top-down control or any form of uniformity of provision. So the new role of the state is focused on four functions. The state is responsible for ensuring that everyone has equal access to services. It's responsible for setting and enforcing standards of quality, and for collecting and investing funds and distributing those funds in order to achieve equality of access, and in supporting new models of ownership and supporting and coordinating the services across the silos that they tend to operate in order to get the best outcomes. So the state is the coordinator, the investor on all our behalfs, as it were, the setter of standards, and the body responsible for ensuring equal access. And that's a very particular way of looking at the role of the state. So instead of it being about top-down provision, it becomes the facilitator and the enabler. We now get on to the question of UBS in practice. In a way, this is as long as a piece of string. We've got a lot of it in the book, and do get the book, because I'm not going to be able to tell you everything that we've said about it tonight. There are some leaflets outside. Some of you may have picked them up that give you a discount if you want to use the promotional code on the leaflet, the flyer. I'm not going to make any money out of this, but I do think it's, you know, I do want you to buy it and read it. So I'm just going to give you a quick run through some of the areas that we cover in the book. If you take, for example, housing. So how would you make housing into a universal basic service? You might start by establishing an entitlement, which isn't established, that everybody has a right to housing. Although it's sort of implicit, but it's not a strong entitlement. You would then have a large public building and refurbishment program. So the state would take responsibility for extending the provision of housing. You would try to ensure that you had high quality mixed neighbourhoods with tenant control, and you can learn lessons from Vienna and from Copenhagen and probably from lots of other places as well. So what we've done in the book is we've set out where we think the best examples are and suggested what the best elements for each of these areas of need might be. With childcare, well, you would want as well universal access. With well-trained and suitably paid staff, we've argued elsewhere actually that childcare workers should be paid the same and have the same conditions of work as primary school teachers. Parents should be involved in how the childcare provision is designed and delivered. And there are the best example, in my view, although there are plenty of other good examples in other countries, is Norway, where they've got a really excellent system where everybody has access, and it's set up in a way that has been going for a long time, is tried and tested. So Norway is a good example there. Well, with adult social care, my goodness, I don't know where we are in Scotland with adult social care, but with we've been going round and round in England, certainly. You know, yes, everybody says we've got to have a better social care system, but nobody seems to be able to settle on a model for how we can provide it. But what we'd be looking for is, first and foremost, with adult social care, which is different from childcare in this respect, is you want to do everything you could in terms of collective action to prevent people needing that care. So you start with prevention, how to make that service not needed by people. But obviously there are going to be people who need it, and therefore you need to be sure that you have adequate support for the informal carers, you've got a good formal care, and you've got well-trained and suitably paid staff again, and that it's properly funded and supported, and everybody has access who needs it, regardless of their ability to pay. And we found a good example of a funding system in Germany that we've described in the book. With transport, well, we suggest that you start with free buses everywhere, that everybody gets a free bus pass, like you do if you're over 60 and you live in London, probably in Glasgow as well, get free bus passes. And it would make a huge difference. So free buses, but as we point out, and as others have pointed out, there's no point having a free bus pass if the buses aren't there. So you need investment in a good stock of buses. You need clever, smart people planning so that the routes connect with one another, so that they go where people need them to go. So you've got a combination of the policies that will make that happen, the investment that will make sure the buses are there, and the entitlement that enable you to ride. And information, well, what we said about information broadly is that, by the way, just to point out, if you look to France, they've got a very interesting way of how they fund their public transport. It may not be good in all places, but it's a darn sight better than it is here. And in Tallinn, in Estonia, they've got free buses for everyone in the capital. On information, we didn't really find anywhere we could point to and say, yes, that's what we need to do, but we made the point, and this is not an original point, but that access to the internet should be a utility, not a commodity, should be regarded as something that we all have access to, and the provider should have a universal service obligation. So that's something that we would like to develop. And although it's not on the slide here, we looked at food as well. When my colleagues at the Institute for Global Prosperity first brought out the idea of universal basic services, they used food as one of their exemplars. And they ended up talking quite a lot about food banks. So we got a bit worried about that after a while, because all these ideas, the way we frame these ideas and develop them, it's a work in progress. So we thought a bit more about food, because obviously it is a basic need. And clearly, people don't, if we say nutrition rather than food, adequate nutrition, people don't get adequate nutrition. So there's a combination of things. You could have public policies and measures that ensure that food is accessible to people, you need a good agricultural policy. You need to have to fight against the food deserts, so that you want to make sure there's supplies of food available across the country. So those are things you need to do. You can also institute a much better policy of making sure everyone gets food through schools. So there's free school meals for everyone. There's free meals for kids in the holidays. There's decent nutrition for people in prisons and in hospitals. And so there's a range of policies. So it's a complex idea. You need to think about the free, where you can supply free meals. You want to put the food banks out of business. There shouldn't be no such thing as food banks run by charities that people are forced to go to. So, and you need a decent income support system so that people can afford to buy food. Anyway, that's in the book, but it's complicated. Now, the benefits of UBS. What we argue here is that if you do take this approach, you're going to get serious benefits on four fronts: on equity, equality, efficiency, solidarity, and sustainability. So going through those one by one. On equality, public services are worth far more to poor households. They're very well, there's lots of evidence, they're very redistributive. Poor households would have to spend about 3/4 of their income on existing services if they weren't free. And there's a research by the OECD showed that they reduce income inequalities by about 20%. On efficiency, and we've learned a lot actually since the 1990s when we started introducing market rules into the healthcare system and other public services, we've learned a lot about the inefficiency of competition and choice and sort of an individualistic approach to service provision. We found that services that are collectively provided tend to give better value for money than markets when it comes to meeting the needs that we all share. Not meeting wants, but meeting the needs that we all share. And classic example is the fact that in the United States, people spend twice as much on healthcare altogether and have lower life expectancy than we do in the UK. And the other point to make here about efficiency is that you put money in and it is an investment, and that investment yields dividends in terms of people's well-being, of people working better together, of a flourishing society. On solidarity, well, it really, the idea of solidarity is at the very heart of universal basic services. It's about pooling resources and sharing risks, which build in turn mutual empathy, regard, interdependence. We learn through universal basic services how we are dependent on each other and we can't live just on our own as individuals. And that calculations that are based on individual market transactions tend to drive people apart. Then on sustainability, again, this is a long story which I'm reducing to a very brief one here, but there are three ways really that we think that universal basic services can encourage sustainable development. Firstly, that they are preventative. They prevent things going bad that would then make people unhappy, make people have a lower quality of life, and cost more money to cure. So they're preventative. In addition, we would say that they employ people. Employing people in the service sector helps to stabilize the economy, so it can help to create a more sustainable economy. And last but absolutely not least, most importantly, that the collective provision of services to meet needs is much more sustainable, much more amenable, if you like, to encouraging sustainable behaviour, to cutting GHG emissions, to reducing the amount of use of natural resources. Because you've got a collective framework, in which it happens, and there's no competition there. So it's sustainable on social, economic, and environmental grounds. Now, I want to move on to talk about UBI and cash payments. Obviously, they're both essential. You have to have an income support system alongside universal basic services. We've estimated the cost of introducing a program that we've described in the book, which is basically about extending the idea of universal basic services to housing, childcare, adult social care, transport, and the extension of access to the internet to digital information, to be in the region of 4 to 5% of GDP across OECD countries. It's very hard to pin it down, and I would want you please to be a bit generous with us about that, because no one has done the work yet. I hope that work will be done, but that is our, it's almost not quite back of envelope. What we've done is we've looked at how much it costs in other countries and tried to consolidate it. So that's what we think it would cost to introduce the programme of services that we've suggested in the book. Now, a generous guaranteed income protection scheme is fiscally compatible with this. At the New Economics Foundation, we have proposed a scheme that goes alongside universal basic services, and the net cost of that is 5.8% GDP. And what this scheme includes is restoring child benefit to 2010 levels in real terms, swapping the personal allowance for a cash payment to all but those who are very rich, improving social security payments by 5% for all, and removing caps and reducing the rate at which benefits are withdrawn. So it's a reform of the social security system, and we think that that is compatible. By contrast, if you take something like universal basic income, or if you take the idea of universal basic income, which is to give everybody the same amount, regardless of whether they need it or not, the question then is, at what level do you pay that money? If the money is paid at a level where people can live on it, that it is a sufficient level, then it's not compatible fiscally with what we're suggesting. The ILO's estimates have suggested that it would cost somewhere between 20 and 30% of GDP. A lot of advocates of UBI say, well, never mind that, let's just have a partial UBI. Now, that's fine, up to a point, because it depends on how big it is, because that has obviously that determines how much it costs overall. But many people see a partial UBI as a route to a full or sufficient UBI. And that, so if you're having a partial UBI, that's okay. If it's modest, we think it's a waste of money to give money to people who don't need it. We can discuss that if you like. Don't really want to talk about UBI, but it always comes up, so I'm trying to deal with it here. But we think that it's if it's going to go to any level anywhere near sufficiency, anywhere above a very, very modest level, it's incompatible with what we're suggesting, both fiscally and ideologically. And what we think we're suggesting is about shared needs and collective action to meet the needs we all share. It's a collective effort, and we think that it is ideologically, not only would the cost of UBI make it impossible to afford more and better public services, collective services, but also there's an ideological battle there, because UBI is about giving people money so they can go and spend it in the marketplace. And we think it's better to take collective action. You may not agree. And then the final point about this is, by enlarging the social wage, you actually reduce the amount of money that people, the amount of disposable income that people need in order to flourish. So if you think of UBS as a virtual income that's available to everyone according to need, not ability to pay, we think that's a better way of looking at how we can help each other to flourish. And I have done this very... well, it wasn't me that did it, but This is based on, this is just to show how the costs compare. The two on the left-hand side there are cash only, no services. So you've got the cost of a sufficient UBI, is the brown column, and a partial UBI is the blue column. You get no services with the money that's spent on those two. The original proposal for universal basic services is the green column. That does include, that doesn't include any cash. And then the NEF proposal, which includes social security reform and the universal basic services, is the one on the yellow one on the right here. And you see it's very near the partial UBI. Partial UBI is slightly more, but with the partial UBI, you're not spending any money on services. So that's a kind of very, very crude, quite provocative comparison. It's not in the book, but it's trying to say there's an incompatibility here. It's because some people will say, well, you know, we like the idea of universal basic income, we like the idea of universal basic services, let's have them both together. Well, only up to a point. So in conclusion then, what we're aiming to do is to build more and better collective services for all according to need, not ability to pay, as a matter of right, plus a reformed social security system that gives everyone a guarantee that their income will not fall below an agreed minimum, which is very different from what we've got now. We maintain that UBS offers is useful, this set of ideas is useful because it offers a principled framework that challenges conventional economic thinking and can be applied in all areas of need. But we don't think it's any kind of magic bullet. Pooling resources and sharing risks so that all our basic needs are met, that requires a robust, many-sided political program and strong, sustained public funding. So I hope I've tried to explain that it isn't just about, you can't just magic up these services. It's about gradually developing them and building them up, but from this principled starting point. And collective services, if they are well organized and democratically controlled and adequately funded, they're the best hope that we have, we believe, in promoting equality, efficiency, solidarity, and sustainability. So that's a summary of our arguments, and I'll just leave you with this slide, which is it sort of sums up UBS in a nutshell. So reclaim the collective ideal and work together to meet the needs that we all share by enlarging the social wage. Thank you.